imagine living in a place with no public transportation, not even a taxi. The nearest airport is hundreds of miles away. There's only one small grocery store, no sit-down restaurant. It's an hour's drive to the nearest hospital and shopping mall, and employment options are limited. Put this way, who would want to live in a small town? More than 30 million Americans, that's who. I'm Anne Strange-Hampson. Today, the culture, community, and powerful appeal of small-town living. Wisconsin novelist David Rhodes will be joining us in a bit to talk about his own experiences of living in and writing about small towns. But first, let's get some facts. Robert Wuthnow is a sociologist at Princeton. He's just finished a massive study of small-town life in America. And Robert, thanks for being here.
Sure.
So your team did 700 in-depth interviews with people who live in small communities. So could you start out, just tell us who you talked to?
We talked to people all over the country so that we had regional diversity. We talked to people from different ethnic groups and racial backgrounds. And we talked to a lot of town leaders like mayors and preachers and school superintendents and teachers, in addition to just ordinary residents.
Well, one of the things, there were a bunch of things you found that surprised and intrigued me. For instance, when you asked people why they choose to live in small towns, one thing a lot of people told you is that they really like the diversity.
Yeah, that surprised me too. Partly it reflects a difference in how people talk about diversity. So when people said they appreciated diversity, part of what they meant was that they actually knew people who were different from themselves. Because being in a small place, there maybe was only one cafe in town. So if you had coffee at the cafe, you were likely to run into somebody and get to know them who was different from yourself.
Yeah, who's there that guy? You talked with one guy who said something like, here, when you go into a coffee shop, the richest person in town could be on one side of you and the poorest guy in town could be on the other side of you. You know, you might not be having dinner at each other's houses, but you still know each other and you have a sense of how each other is doing.
Yeah. What intrigued me about that comment is that it also related to what many people in small towns told us, which is that everybody feels like they're equal or they feel like they're the same or they have something in common. Well, why would that be if you're sitting there and you know that the guy on one side is wealthy and the guy on the other side of you is not? Partly the difference is just the fact that you have something in common because you're living in the same space. So you share in common concerns about how the town is doing. Is it growing? Is it declining? How's the school doing? What's the athletic team doing this year? How are the crops doing if it's a farming area? So that was part of the equality. The other part, which I thought was even more interesting, you talk to the wealthier people in small towns. They often engaged in what might be called conspicuous underconsumption. They didn't live quite as lavishly as they could have. There was this one guy I talked about in the book who farmed 9,000 acres. I mean, that's a huge amount of land. He was doing very well. But he drove around town in an old pickup. And part of the reason he did that was because he just wanted to fit in like everybody else.
So that suggests that there's an element of classlessness to small towns. Are there classes in small towns?
There are classes in small towns, sure. There are the gentry.
The gentry?
The gentry, yeah. People who own land, or in some cases, they're the doctor in town or the lawyer in town, or they're there because they've inherited money. It was surprising to me how many pretty wealthy people there are in small towns. We talked to one man who lived in a town of about 2,000 people. He'd started some kind of software company and he was worth $100 million, but he still lived in that town. So you've got the gentry. Then you have the kind of educated service worker class, the teachers, the nurses, a lot of people who work in government offices. And then you have more of the kind of working class, people who work for hourly wages, people who usually have not graduated from college, although they may have had a little bit of college. You certainly have very poor people, people who are on welfare or people, for that matter, who've moved to a small town because it's inexpensive to live there. And then, of course, you have a lot of retirees, some of whom may be fairly comfortable and some of whom may be struggling. So, yeah, those are the class differences.
One of the interesting things you probed was the kind of values that lead people to choose small town living. A big part of the American dream is the notion of success, by which we usually mean getting to the top of a profession or an income bracket, which is less likely to happen if you choose to live in a small town. So the question is, do people who do live in small towns and choose to do so, is that because they have a different version of the American dream?
Yes, yes, they do. We talk to a lot of people who clearly very talented, had college degrees, graduate degrees in some cases. But at some point in their career, they had decided not to keep climbing the success ladder. They wanted instead to have more time, especially for their family. They talked about it as pursuing a balanced life. They wanted to be in a place where they could be close to their kids, close to the schools, close to the school's activities, in many cases close to aging parents or even grandparents. And they did talk about wanting a slower pace of life. In some cases, it was just time to hang out, time to relax, or time to go hunting and fishing, or time to just sit on the porch and read the newspaper. So they did have a pretty distinctly different view of the American dream.
Hmm. Now, another central issue in small town living has to do with community. You know, it's an easy word to say, but it's a subtle word, not necessarily so easy to get a feeling for. What do you think people mean when they use that word community?
And that was what motivated my interest in the study more than any other, because as a sociologist, we talk about community a lot. We point to small towns even, and we say, well, people in small towns have community. What do they mean? They meant several things. One was that they feel like they know everybody. We wanted to push that because if a town has no more than 1,000 people, it's not likely that people there really do know everybody else.
Hmm.
And so we ask them, well, how many people do you really know when you get right to it? How many people do you actually hang out with? How many people could you identify by first name? 50? 100 at most? Certainly not all 1,000. The temptation is to say, oh, well, these people are wrong. They live in small towns and they're dumb. They don't know what they're talking about. But that's not true either, because when you think about that, when you start asking people further questions, then what you find is that what community means is familiarity. So even though there's somebody who drives past you on Main Street in their pickup truck and you don't know that person's name, you've seen that person before. You've seen them at the gas station. You've seen them in the grocery store. So they're familiar. And you can identify whether they live in the town or not.
You can tell who's a stranger and who's not.
That's right. You can absolutely tell. We had people tell us exactly how you wave at somebody as you're passing them, you know, which fingers to hold up and so forth, so that you know. So it's familiarity that matters more than anything else. That's point number one. Point number two is that the conversations that happen in small towns are the kind that might be criticized as being gossip, and they are indeed gossip, but what they communicate is that the people you know also know other people who some of the other people that you know would know. In other words, there's a kind of extended network. You're walking to the post office, you meet somebody, they say, hi, how you doing? You say, fine. They say to you, I hear your aunt's in the hospital. Immediately, you know that they know somebody who knows your aunt, and of course you know your aunt. So the kind of sense that you come away with is, yeah, this is a community that's kind of connected, even though we don't know everybody.
You know, to some people that would not be appealing.
Absolutely. That's right. And that's true even in small towns. We talked to people who said, I don't walk to the post office because, you know, they're busy. I mean, people in small towns are busy too. And so they
might
don't
just think,
to spend 20
who
minutes.
Are you and why the hell are you asking me about my aunt?
Well, yeah, that's right.
Okay. So, yeah. So some people like that kind of gossipy conversation, the feeling that everybody knows everybody else's business. Yeah. And what's another thing about community?
So the other thing is that small towns have these kind of community-wide events. It may be a funeral. It may be homecoming weekend. It may be some kind of special thing that they've created in hopes of attracting tourist, Cinco de Mayo, or they may have an Oktoberfest, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that does, this is interesting how that creates community, because it gives everybody a sense that, all right, you pitch in, people care about the town, people do come out, it's kind of like a holiday, it's a festive occasion, but it doesn't take much time. So you think about that, you say, that's really clever how that's worked out. It's not the kind of community that people have to work at a lot, but it still works.
Well, what's really interesting is you're saying that there's an aspect of community that is it kind of lives in the imagination. You know, it has to do with rituals.
It absolutely lives in the imagination. The big ones, of course, are the athletic events. So if the town has a school, they hope that they have a decent football team or basketball team or something else. And some of the towns we visited, the attendance at the football game was greater than the population of the town. People would come in from the countryside. So they had a winning team. It was wonderful. And then when they didn't have a winning team, it was just terrible. And you talk to people and say, oh, you know, we just feel very bad about our town because the team is losing this year. Well, that was important partly because of the really central role that the school plays in a small town. And this was one of the regrets that many people had. And because in the smaller town, I mean, nationally, more than 50% of all towns have lost population in the last 30 years. But among the smallest towns, the towns that only had 1,000 people, up to 70% of those towns have lost population, and lots of schools have closed. So if the school closed, the people who were left there really felt it. They said, oh, you know, it's just ripped the heart out of our town. We used to hear children on the playground. We used to be able to go to football games, and now we can't. So when they talked about how community is changing or even how community is dying, it was those symbolic events. This again goes to the point that community is kind of in the imagination. It was the symbolism of the school having closed, or the symbolism of driving down Main Street and seeing the vacant lot where the lumber yard used to stand. Those were the kinds of things that people really said mattered to them.
Hmm. What's the future of small towns? Because across America, really across the planet, we're seeing growing urbanization. Do people who live in small towns worry that their particular way of life, their town even, is dying out?
They don't. Probably the biggest surprise I came away with is how resilient small towns are and how much resilience the people who live in small towns feel about them. Partly because when I say that we found that more than 50% of all small towns are declining in population, a lot of those towns are very small. And a majority of the people who live in small towns live in larger small towns, which means that if a town has at least 5,000 people, it's not doing too badly. It's got actually a better than even chance of holding its own in terms of population. And so if you think about the 30 million people roughly who currently live in town and you say, what is that number going to be 10 years from now or 20 years from now? My prediction is that it's still going to be at least 30 million, if not maybe 35 or 40 million, all of which means that the future for towns of a decent size already isn't too bad.
Well, that's good to hear. Robert, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you.
Robert Wuthnow is a sociologist at Princeton University. His new study is called Small Town America, Finding Community, Shaping the Future. We're going to take a quick break, and then novelist David Rhodes joins us with stories of his fictional small town, Words, Wisconsin.
This small town is my home. It was bypassed years ago. It's the heart and breath and soul of everything I've ever known. I cannot let it go.
I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. No one writes about small-town life more vividly or compassionately than David Rhodes. His award-winning novel, Driftless, was a series of interlocking stories set in the fictional small town of Words, Wisconsin. It burst onto the literary scene kind of unexpectedly. David had come out with three novels years earlier, but after a motorcycle accident, he stopped publishing. Driftless was the first novel he published in decades. NPR's reviewer called it the best work of fiction to come out of the Midwest in many years. And now David Rhodes is back with a sequel, Jewelweed. Mostly new characters and the same small town. David, welcome. It's always such a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here with you, Ann.
You lived for many years in or near a small town, didn't you, in the Wisconsin's Driftless area?
Absolutely. Right down the road from a little town called Valton, which was an unincorporated town of maybe about 40 homes. And it started out with, there used to be a working gas station there and a repair shop and a couple other things, but now there are no shops at all.
What drew you to it?
I don't know. I just always was kind of a small town guy. Myself, and actually I live outside of town, but in the suburbs of the little town. But I don't know. I just always, you know, somehow... fit in with me. I graduated from a high school in a class of 12, and eventually graduated from Marlboro College with an entire student body. It was 175 in the middle of the Green Mountains. So, you know, I'm a small town kind of guy.
But that's so interesting because that's just what we were talking about earlier was what does it mean to be a small town person or a small town guy? I think it's more complicated than just you don't like too many people around you.
Well, I don't know. And I'm not sure. A lot of it has just to do with what you're familiar with. But some of it has to do with just how easily you become comfortable does that noise refer to me? Does that have something to do with me? And when you're in a small town, practically everything has something to do with you. And the difficulty of living in a larger place is that you keep thinking that this has something to do with me when in fact it doesn't, because most of the noises and sights and sounds and smells really have nothing to do with you at all, and there isn't enough of you to be concerned with them. When you're a small town guy, you keep thinking that there is some reason.
I can't decide if I think that sounds like a good thing or not a good thing. I think I'd rather just let that wall of sound go past me and think, yeah, it doesn't have anything to do with me.
Well, you need to do that, and that's a matter of whether you can acclimate or not, because you learn to shut out the things that don't have anything to do with you.
So you've written two books now that are set mostly, if not completely, in this fictional small town, Words, Wisconsin. What a great name to begin with.
Yeah,
how'd you come up with that?
Well, just as you know, when you drive around Wisconsin, you go through little towns. Often the only thing that identifies the town is a little green metal sign that's on the end of a pole, and it's just got the name of the town on it. And the first thing that occurred to me was that, wouldn't it be something if the name of the town was Words? I mean, it would be kind of a and I thought, and I like that. But then it also had to do with, a while back I read an article written by someone that said that postmodern literature didn't need characters anymore, that just the language was enough to evoke the culture. And I thought, no, I want my characters to stand up out of the book and walk in, walk over and shake your hand. And to make that point pretty clear, I had them come from words.
It's also just the perfect name for a town invented by a writer, of course. I want to keep talking with you about your town and about small towns, but we've had a couple of callers on the line, too, who I think maybe are small town residents. So let's hear from what a couple of other people might have to say. Roger in Spring Green gave us a call. Hey, Roger.
Hey, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
I had just a few ideas I wanted to throw in. This is a subject near and dear to my heart. I grew up south of La Crosse and by Seneca in the country. My graduating class was 36 students, so three times the size of yours, David. The sense of community, I completely agree with that. And I later moved to Madison and lived there for about 10 years, so I can compare and contrast a bit. And in a small town, whether you go to the grocery store or a gas station or out to eat or to a play or a community event, you always see somebody that you know. In Madison, this isn't so. And even though a city says that it's this big, diverse thing, most people in a city, from what I saw, agreeing with the sociologist, they still stay in small groups of connections. The whole people of the city are not really that integrated. In a couple more ideas, and then I'll just stop. In a small town, there are not classes or cliques nearly as much, but it's more of a socioeconomic gradation or continuum that's more integrated.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is, when you were talking with the sociologist, is that, the socioeconomic classes, so you might have, doctors and lawyers and CEOs that really, in a city, they go to the more expensive country clubs, the more expensive restaurants, the more expensive golf courses, whatever. And in a small town, you don't have, the difference between going to a cheap, inexpensive restaurant or going to the more expensive, there isn't much difference. And so you go to the same grocery store, and the people are all more integrated. Going back to my high school class, with only 36 students, there was not the college-bound course and the maybe going to make it through or maybe drop out courses. You, at some point, whether it's in an English class or Fayette or shop class or whatever, you ended up mixing with everybody, both at school, and the same thing happens in the community.
David, does that resonate for you with your experience of small-town life?
Oh, that's an excellent point, just excellent. Ann and I were talking just a little while ago that it does seem that in small towns, as opposed to larger towns where, because when you're around a lot of people all the time, you're more or less forced to put people in categories so that people that wear a certain type of clothes or drive a certain type of car or live in a certain type of place, you'll end up categorizing them. But in small towns, there just simply aren't enough people for those categories, and they bleed out of they bleed out of the lines, and you have to, after a while, accept them as individuals. And when you can't put people in categories, the whole deal changes because you'll be sitting next to, like you say, you'll be eating next to someone that's wealthier than you on one side and much less wealthier than you on the other side, and it really doesn't make any difference.
The other thing that comes out for me in your books, David, is your characters, they don't necessarily all know each other, but they are all connected. So one of them might be very close to a very good friend of another one. And so everybody's linked, and some of those links are strong and some are weaker. And then that changes. Is that another aspect of small town living, that feeling that everybody's sort of interlocked?
Oh, absolutely. That's like John Muir used to say, that if you pull on something, you find it attached to the rest of the universe. And that's always true. But in small towns, it's just more evidently true. You can find that, whatever you do will affect someone, and that will affect other people. And the cascade of effects, is immediate and visible.
Of course, that's exactly what some people don't like about small towns. Like, the positive is the negative and vice versa. I mean, Roger, that I'm curious about for you, having moved back to Spring Green, it sounds like you both love it, but are there things that are less good?
Am I back on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Are there things that are less good? That actually breaks up a point I was going to say is there's an idea in this country that I have termed myself the urban superiority complex. And there are things that are different. And, yes, if I want to see a professional play or I want to go to a really good restaurant, I go to Madison, which is an hour away. People here, one of the things that I think people in a small town are more honest and more accountable because you can't get away with things because somebody knows what you did. So people know more of your business, but people are also willing to help you if you need it.
Mm. Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for calling. And actually, also Charles from Ingleside, Illinois is calling. Hi, Charles.
I'd like to hear the guests talk about how the towns of Massachusetts and Connecticut are affected by the town meeting government, where the people elect all the office holders and then they receive the potential budget for next year and then they vote yes or no for everything that happens, both legally and financially, in their town.
Okay. We changed guests, so I think you're thinking of the sociologist who was on earlier. So, but David,
when I lived in Vermont, they had these town meetings, which was something that I wasn't used to. And you'd come together and discuss everything. I mean, it was just a wonderful forum. It was impossible to have any decisions come out of it. But it was really a time where, you know, people would just come in and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk over any kind of civic issue that concerned anything. And they went on for hours. They were just wonderful forums. And one of the reasons, I mean, and I think they influenced the politics of the entire state of Vermont. You know, I think that's kind of the area you're talking about, and it really makes for a more stable community. I think partly because you can't make any decisions that alter from the way it is. But they were really lively events.
Vermont is almost a small town in and of itself. It's actually my parents live in Vermont. There's a kind of underground movement of Vermonters who would like the state to secede from the nation. I want to talk about your new novel, Jewelweed, and I think there's kind of a nice segue in that small towns, yes, can be really wonderful. There can be that wonderful sense of community, but they can also be a little claustrophobic, and that feeling that you can't ever get away from not only the things you've done, but the things maybe people in your past have done. There's a section in your book I was going to ask if you would read. I should set it up a bit. That's this part where your character, Blake, is a young man who's been in prison, in a supermax prison, for about 10 years. And he's been released, and a lot of the book follows his troubles and his efforts to make a transition back to being out in the world. And he comes to realize that we carry our own prisons with us. Anyway, I wondered if you'd read that section. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Okay, I think I do. This is Blake basically reflecting on his feeling I can't remember the way to refer to that actually, but his feeling about having been born into a situation that he didn't determine himself. Anyway, as far back as Blake could remember, he'd felt behind, born too late, an unneeded afterthought in a long march of human events that had already prescribed the nature of everything around him. Monuments to earlier events were everywhere. His father had a father who had a father, and there were stories of all of them doing things Blake could never hope to equal. Likewise, his mother had a mother, and so on. They acted out of habits passed down from generations before. The laws governing what couldn't be done, the kinds of work people engaged in, the ruling order of traffic lights, convenience stores, row farming, drive-through windows, everything had been determined earlier. The streets were named for families who no longer lived along them. His father's house was called the Old Sanders Place after a family he'd never met. The schools he attended had dates chiseled into the cornerstones. Even the prisons he'd been locked inside had come ready-made, part and parcel of a time-honored penal practice that dated back hundreds of years and depended upon developed traditions, enacted laws, and evolved conventions of social and economic power that remained as far removed from questioning as they were from understanding.
That's not really so much a small town quality as it is the weight of tradition and time, I guess, that he's feeling.
Yes, absolutely. That one of the things I enjoyed wrestling with in this book was the, you know, our human experience of time, and the problem as it opposed to me, as it occurred to me in the way we address time, is that everything we know, everything we have any kind of certainty in, is rooted in the past. And in order to be certain about our lives, in order to understand our lives, we're looking backwards. But we're living forwards so that, we, as much as we want things not to change, there continues to always be something new introduced. And we can explain those new things after they happen, but I think we experience them with a sense of wonder and magic, and then later try to tie them into a system where we think, well, this was almost a deterministic outcome of the things that had happened before. But I wanted to play with that idea where we really are, in terms of our experience, we don't know what's going to happen as in real time. But after it happens, then we translate it through the events of the past, and we at least, you know, have the certainty and have the comfort of being able to offer a rationalization for why things happen the way they do.
Well, that's the comfort, right? Because that feeling of living on the cusp of the future, where everything's always just happening, that's terrifying.
Oh, it's as frightening as it can be. But in the book, most of the characters really have something in their past that they're trying to outlive. And so to stay in the past is really a type of condemnation. And so they're constantly looking for new experiences that will help offset the experiences that are weighing them down. And so they're exploring the idea, you know, the book explores the idea of time healing. I mean, we tell ourselves, well, time will heal. Well, what do we actually mean by that? Because I actually believe we never really forget the experiences we want to outdistance, but we come into a different relationship with them because of the new experiences that we have to offset them and to come into a different and hopefully a more successful dialogue with those injuries of the past.
I find it so interesting then that one of your central characters, this guy Blake we're talking about, he's just spent 10 years in prison. And we call being in prison doing time.
Exactly.
You must have thought about
that. Yes, serving time. Yes, exactly. It's like he reflects in prison, you know, he longs for the time, for the days in which he could forget what time it was, because he says in prison you're on the front edge of, you know, it's like one of the serving time or doing time, one of the things is you're always painfully aware of exactly what time it is and your relationship to that ongoing plodding nature of duration.
Well, and if I understand you right, what you're saying is that when we say time heals, it's not just the passage of time, it's that the new things that happen to us, our new lived life, is what heals, and gradually the past mistakes recede. But if you're in prison and you're doing time, nothing much happens. There's an enormous monotony, so it's sort of as though you can't escape the thing that you've done.
Yeah, this was, and I tried to portray that as well as I could, because I spent some time visiting a prisoner or two in the supermax over a period of about a year and a half, and coming to understand the difficulties that they had, and kept in touch with them after they were released. And one of the real difficulties is that, especially in a supermax situation, there's not much happens during the day, and then when you're out, all of a sudden you just can't hardly keep up, because there's more happens in a half hour than you're used to. So you actually have a problem of sensory overload where you feel assaulted by the events that normal people just learn, you know, to take in stride. And this ends up being a problem, but it's another time-related issue of how many events, you know, will fit into a certain period of time.
We're talking with David Rhodes. He's the award-winning author of Driftless, and he's got a brand new sequel out. It's called Jewelweed. He's lived in Wisconsin for many years, and both novels are set in the fictional small town of Words, Wisconsin. If you live in a small town and have something you'd like to tell us about it, you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Ann Strangchamps, and this is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking with David Rhodes, novelist, about his new book, Jewelweed, sequel to the award-winning Driftless. This one is just as good, if not better. David, where does the title Jewelweed come from?
Well, it's a plant that is actually something of an invasive species in the state, but it's a jewelweed grows often in ditches and other wet places. And it's one of the loveliest in bloom, which it blooms late in August. And it's just a beautiful plant when it's in bloom. It had the small flowers have a tendency to hold on to drops of dew. So you'll have a little bit of drop of dew, you know, holding off of this. And it really is jewel-like. They're also a succulent plant. And, you know, if you break them open, the ointment inside is actually at least a palliative for poison ivy. But the thing about them is, as beautiful as they are a touch-me-not, and there's just no way that you can pick them and take them home because they just collapse as soon as they're interfered with. And I like that idea in terms of this issue of a human experience of time and the newness of our experience. And these have to be enjoyed where they are, because they can't be taken and put in a sequestered or a special environment. You can't take them home and put them on your table. You have to enjoy them where they are, and they're a kind of a ditch beauty, which emphasizes the quality or the value of ordinary experiences looked at in detail.
I love that, and there are so many moments in this book that, honestly, reading it, there were times I just had to put it down for a minute, because it's those moments where, they're mystical moments, really, where suddenly a character has an experience of the mundane. It's often first thing in the morning, stepping outdoors with a cup of coffee, and something like jewelweed or, I don't know, the grass will just strike you. And well, actually, there's a passage I marked. I wonder if you'd read that. And it's the same character, Blake, and it's lovely that he gets to have this moment.
Okay, this is after he's moved out. He's been living with his father, but now he's been allowed to move out into a farmhouse. And the night in the farmhouse, you know, is just a little too isolated for him, and it kind of unnerves him. But the morning is a counterbalance to that. The morning, however, had an altogether different story to tell. After washing in cold water, dressing, making coffee, and carrying a steaming cup of it outside to drink, his surroundings unfolded before him in a way Blake had never experienced before. The vacancy of the night before had been replaced by the silent marvel of dew and the plant life shaking off sleep, regrowing the world. A new sun rose in the east, and the beads of moisture hanging from the spokes of his motorcycle burned like blue diamonds. A chorus of wild fledglings sang about the significance of eating weed seeds, having feathers, and flying wherever they wanted. The air felt alive, and he participated in its vitality with every breath.
Oh, I love that. And there's another moment I remember earlier in the book. There's a boy who's sitting looking out over a small lake or pond and watching the geese, and he starts wondering what it would be like to be a goose, and he imagines that there would be a seamless feeling between you and the natural world, and that's what he craves, this seamlessness. So why are these moments so hard to have?
Well, I don't know if they're hard to have. It's just that there aren't many of them. because when you have them, they happen so naturally. I remember the time that I had the geese perception. I was in a hospital in Hillsboro, and I was looking out, and I had one of those nice rooms that look out on the little lake there in Hillsboro, and there were geese out there, and it just, I don't know, I just had a prolonged moment of just imagining what it would be like to have your feet dangling down in the water and the sun on your back, and then be surrounded by all these other geese. And then they put their head back and they fall asleep, and the rocking of the and the way it is in water, first of all, if something disturbs the water, you can feel every little thing because, you know, you're in it yourself. And it just seemed like, indeed, a seamless connection, yet at peace rather than, you know, we often think of a seamless connection to being one where all our nerves are wired up. But that would make us jumpy because, you know, every little twitch would send us into some kind of a crisis. But, hey, that doesn't happen with geese. I mean, they're all and because of the group, you know, they're so comfortable with the group. And if they do have, you know, if there is something, they all take off at once. And yeah, I don't know. It was a wonderful moment. But it'd be nice to have more of those. But part of the reason that they're so gratifying and so significant is because
we can't make them happen, and no, we don't have all that many of them. So you're saying they're like jewel weeds.
You know, exactly.
You can't cut them. You can't take them home. You can't cultivate and make them happen. You just have to enjoy them when you stumble on one.
Yeah, exactly. Those moments are they jerk you up and basically get you out of the false idea that you're in control. I mean, you're participating, but you're not in control. You're not setting the agenda. You're basically receiving as opposed to ordering.
The one thing you can do, though, I mean, and my thanks to you as a writer, writers can remind you of them. And somehow being reminded of those moments and having them kind of brought to life, you get a little, it's not the moment itself, but I like to think we learn to become a little more receptive to them, maybe.
Well, I don't know. I guess that's what many writers strive for, is at least is trying to come into some kind of a communal participation with the readers and the readers' lives and those kinds of things that everybody accepts as a general experience that we can all talk about together.
We've got more callers on the line. Stan is calling from Valton, who has a question for you. Hi, Stan.
Yes, hello. David, hello. You may recognize
me. Hey, Stan, good to hear you.
You can feel free not to if you'd like. I haven't read your new book, David.
Well, your wife has. Why don't you talk to her?
Well, my wife confiscated it on her trip, and so I haven't had a chance. So what I'm
Is she back home yet? She went to Africa.
Yes, I didn't call the chit-chat, David.
Okay, all right, okay.
I'll do that some other time on my own nickel. Say, she mentioned the fact that there were a couple of actual names of real people, and I was curious as to how you arrived at a decision to do that, and if that was a kind of a easy or hard thing to do. And I was just kind of curious because that was one thing that she mentioned right away, that, you know, there were a couple of names of actual people there in your book. And I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I'd love to comment on that. And you know some of those people that I named in there. And I just wanted their names in there. There's no descriptions or characteristics about them. I just wanted their names in there. And they were people that both you and I know, you know, we'll always remember. They're no longer with us. But I wanted them. It's kind of like earlier we were talking about, or I had the passage about in rural areas and other areas, you live on streets that are named for people that are no longer there. Well, that was one of the, you know, those people were very dear to me at one point, and I wanted their names there.
Mm, that's lovely. We've also got Dave on the line from Elroy. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I don't know if this is pertinent anymore, but it seemed this whole discussion about small towns was all about the social aspects of them, And really what draws many of us to small towns, I lived in small towns all my life on purpose, deliberately turned down promotions to stay in small towns, is because really more of the natural environment than of the social environment.
Hmm. Hey, good point, Dave. I think that really is true because, well, part of the reason is, you know, you live in a small town. I don't care wherever you are, but if you just walk, you know, out of town in about 100 yards, you're in the middle of the country. And there are all kinds of different aspects of that, and the natural world does take up a much bigger role in your life. And things like the seasons rinsing through the town really have a much more definite effect on your personal life than the other one. That's an excellent thing, but it's also, I mean, I think people also though in urban areas get a tremendous boost from noticing the birds that live in the area and the bushes and the trees and but you're right, it's more pronounced in small towns. Excellent point, Dave.
Yeah, that is. And Sharon is calling from Berlin. Hi, Sharon.
Berlin,
sorry. Yeah, wrong one. Yeah.
You mentioned something about how much more incoming that this man had after getting out of prison, because there was so much more going on when you're out of prison and in the community. I experienced that same thing when I came home from spending 2 years on the Navajo Reservation, and I think Peace Corps volunteers experienced that same thing. Your value system is changed because of what is important to you, and there's just too much going on in the world today that seems not important to you, and it's quite a transition. I'm sure it was for that person.
Thank you.
Excellent point. Thank you.
Yeah, just thinking about the, that's part of what we're talking about. I think the difference in cultures and the paces of life between cities and small towns. But then there's something sort of even below that. It's as though you're trying to remind us that there's a pace of life that's deeper than our ordinary daily lives. I'm being completely inarticulate, but maybe you know what I'm getting at.
Well, it's again. I think what you're getting at is again the ordinariness. If we, you know, my emphasis in the book is celebrating the ordinary, and it seems like one of the tricks that we often play with ourselves is imagining that we're going to, you know, when we're thinner or we're stronger or we're or we have children, or we have a better car, or we have a better house. We imagine in the future that we're going to be happy then, and in the act of imagining that these things will work out for us, we're actually overlooking the things that are happening right before us. So that was one of the things I wanted to put in there.
What's next for you?
Well, I'm working on another book, It's in some ways a sequel to this one. I'm having a lot of difficulty with it because I'm going to set it in the future with some of the characters from this one, and putting it in the future, you have the same problems as I was just talking about. You imagine the future, and all of a sudden you're not in the present moment. And it also, in terms of literature, you've entered a different genre, because then you're in science fiction if you're looking into the future.
How far into the future are you going to go?
Oh, about 20 years.
Wow. That's fascinating. Just think about how much change we've experienced in the last 20 years.
Well, see, there you go. It's fascinating and terrifying at the same time, because we're all, you know, basically everybody's frightened of the future and what are we, you know, what's going to happen up there. And so I don't know. Anyway, I'm working on that.
And yeah, because we're not actually so much frightened of the future in 100 years. We're really frightened in 20 years. Yes, the future we might have to live through.
Well, yes, exactly. We're going to be 20 years older for one thing, and that ain't good.
David, it's just always such a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for asking me, Anne. Congratulations on your new program.
Oh,
This is a wonderful format for you.
It's fun. David Rhodes is an award-winning author of Driftless and the brand new sequel Jewel Weed. He is one of Wisconsin's literary treasures. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. This is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And thanks to you for listening today.